okay, what's going on?
AudioToYou.com.
The home of quality podcasts.
Stay tuned to this channel.
Shutters Inc. with Bruce Williams and Shelton Muller.
Hi, and welcome to episode 138 of Shutters Inc. This is Bruce Williams from ShuttersIncPodcast.com. With me on the line, once again, via Skype from Melbourne, Mr. Shelton Muller. How are you?
I'm good, mate. I'm good. We were actually, last time we did this podcast, we were sitting across a table, separated by beer glasses and dinner plates.
Absolutely. It was great.
And you're not allowed to say absolutely anymore, you remember? As per podcast 137, I'm not allowed to say fabulous anymore either.
It's our show. We'll do what we like.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah, we won't let our listeners tell us what catchphrases we're allowed to use and not allowed to use. But I must admit, I don't listen to every podcast because, hey, you know, I talk them. I hear enough of my own voice during the day. But I thoroughly enjoyed listening to the last one because it was such a casual chat, and it wasn't just you and me or you, me, and Richard or, you know, whatever. It was actually a whole table full of people who came in the workshop, the models, you know. Well, model one, Natasha. Caroline didn't join in.
Yep.
And isn't she a giggle, Natasha?
Oh, she's great.
to have on a podcast. And then, of course, you know, we had Adam and Mikey join in and Tamara. And I really enjoyed listening to that podcast because to me it was like sitting there and doing it all over again. It was really, really good. I'm glad that you brought that little handheld recording device. It actually did a surprisingly good job.
Yes, it did. But then I had to do a fair bit of post work on that as well. So, yeah.
Uh-huh.
But it does do a good job.
Yeah. Oh, no, I was rather impressed. I mean, you got to remember, Mikey was sitting a fair way away from the microphone.
Yep.
So, you know, but he was still, did you have to bring him up or was it just?
Oh, yeah, I had to boost him a fair bit.
Right.
But that's okay, because I knew that was going to be the case when we recorded. I figured that there was going to be a fair bit of work, you know, riding the levels to get that kind of consistency across the whole mix, you know. And as I said to somebody either on 5MP or on Facebook, it didn't come out, you know, as well as I would have liked, but it was good enough to convey the feeling of the event, and everything was close enough to audible that you could make out what was being said and the context and all that. So it worked from that point of view.
Yeah, and sometimes even in photography, it's the content that really sells. You know, there may be technical errors in a photograph, but it's the content that really sells. I'm thinking of some of the classic images, the classic photojournalist images over the years, like that the one by Robert Capa of the Spanish soldier that's been, you know, he sort of got him in, he's just been hit by a bullet and he's you know, he's falling. And I look at that image and I think it's badly exposed, it's out of focus, it's badly composed, but, you know, forget the technicalities. It's a moment. It's the real. It's the real moment in war.
Yeah.
The real cost of war is a human. You know, a human life. And this is that moment where the bullet enters the human body, and you know that's the reality. I mean, there are so many images that are, you know, technically the photograph that was taken of the young Vietnamese fellow being executed by that cop in Saigon. You know, it's terrible. You know, it's sharp, but it lacks all that. But it's a poignant and powerful image. And if you've ever seen the footage, the video footage of that same event, I was watching a documentary on the 60s the other night, and they actually showed the footage of this young man being executed.
Oh, wow!
And it's moving, to say the least. Because there was a film camera there as well as a still camera.
Right.
And the policeman who executes him, he literally just walks up, pulls out his .38, puts it to his head, blows him away, and walks off. The whole thing takes place in about 4 seconds.
Wow.
There's no, oh, I'll stand here for a minute. And, you know, he just walks up, executes the guy with the bullet, you know, to the temple, and walks off. So the photographer had a half a second to raise his camera and grab the image.
Wow.
And in that particular instance, and he grabs one of the most poignant images from the Vietnam War, one that no doubt helped change the feeling of the war, in, you know, at home. And you could say technically, you know, not the most, but in terms of what it delivers as an image,
yeah.
So, and it's the same with the podcast, mate. Technically, you might not like it, but in terms of what it delivers. Everybody, we've got a lot of comments on you know, episode 137, which is really nice.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think people like feeling at home with us.
Yeah.
Now, is it just me or is there a delay on this line or are you still digesting that 6-inch subway?
There is a massive delay on this line, yeah. What I will do is after we've recorded, I'll have to shift everything around in sync to try and make it flow a little smoother than it is as we are recording it.
Okay, fair enough. I'm wondering whether it's, you know, it's you thinking, what the hell is Shelton talking about?
No, it's not that.
Or whether there's a delay on the line. Okay, fair enough. We've got some emails to catch up with. Should we do that first?
Yeah, why not?
All right, fair enough. Now, we've got, we're going to go through them bit by bit, aren't we, Bruce? Because we've got a fair few emails over the past few weeks that we've gathered that we haven't had much of a chance to talk about.
That's correct, yeah.
So, all right, first one, Jim Rockwell. He says, hey guys, have you ever done a show segment on terms of service agreements? I understand some social network sites, online album sites, and forums could potentially own what you upload to them. Do you know which ones to be cautious of or stay away from? Jim Rockwell. I think that's a very good question. Jim, I have heard the same thing, and I know that it does exist, but to what degree, which sites, and to what degree is that ownership taken? And how can you as a photographer prevent that? I know a lot of photographers prevent any images from being used by watermarking them, so it sort of makes them fairly useless to the website should they want to sell it to someone who, you know, wants to use it for something else. The other thing, of course, is quality. The way Facebook, for instance, compresses an image makes it hardly worthwhile to anybody. And so there would be certain limitations that the site puts on itself. However, it's a very good question. I'm going to do a little bit of research on it, and we'll get back to you, Jim. Do you know anything about this, Bruce?
Not particularly. And one thing I would like to investigate, or have any, if any of the listeners are already across this and would like to chime in with an email or drop us a message somewhere, and that would be the issue of Creative Commons licenses and how that works. I've heard people talk about it before, but I don't completely understand what is implied by a Creative Commons license. I think there are certain levels of Creative Commons, like you can say that this file can be used for certain things as long as it's non-profit, or this cannot be used for anything. So it'd be interesting to hear some more information on that as well.
If you are listening and you know a fair bit about this, hey, please save me some time and send me an email. I really appreciate it because it is actually a valid point that Jim makes, because, you know, a photographer's image is a very personal thing, especially if that photographer is a professional. Or, for instance, if you upload an image of somebody's wedding to your Flickr site or your Facebook site or whatever, and then a company takes it and uses it, it's very personal. So it's a valid point you make, Jim, and we will certainly get back to you on that. And just another one that comes to us from Michael. He says, hi, just wanted to let you guys know that I really appreciate the last couple of shows. So many other shows simply run an interview with some photographer, which is interesting, but not when everyone does it, or news. Your show always puts a big smile on my face. Well, that's nice. I'm glad to do that. That's great. Seriously, it is good to know that you make people happy, and it's nice to know our podcast has a little bit more of a personal element to it, Bruce, I reckon.
Definitely.
Also, he says, really nice to listen to a nice Australian accent, that's you, Bruce, not me, to contrast all the American podcasts out there, because my accent is a serious hybrid of a Canadian, Australian, and whatever else it is. He says that he goes on to say that he's a 29-year-old Swedish guy living in Mexico, and then describes, you know, his abilities. But he makes an interesting point at the end, and something we could talk about, and something we'll probably make a podcast about, Bruce.
Okay.
I'll give his point some time to spin around in my hard drive and, you know, attach itself to a few programs, etc. But he says, one thing, he says, I'm an engineer and not an artist. So for other people, this might be obvious, but hard camera techniques is very easy for me to learn. But composing an image that tells a story and similar soft parts is what I'm trying to get a grip at. And once again, thanks for a great show. I love the way he describes the difference between the technical aspect of photography and the creative aspect of photography as being hard and soft. Yeah. I really like that because one is about technicality and the other one is about creativity. And I would imagine that it would be a fairly frustrating thing to have a serious grip on the technicalities of photography, but not necessarily a brilliant grip on the creative. And Michael, I can only suggest that you keep firing away. And I would love to do an entire podcast on this, Bruce, so we'll have to make a note of that.
Sure.
And I love, like I said, the way that he describes it as the difference between hard and soft. Hard is the technical, and you're not talking about hard in terms of difficulty. You're just talking about hard in terms of the contrast to soft, which is the creative. As a photographer, you really should be, if possible, your first port of call should be the soft part, the creative urge, the creative desire. And then, of course, you know, having the mind that is able to cope with the technicalities. And for some people, either their mind will work one of two ways, not necessarily both. I was talking about this with a friend of mine yesterday. He was saying that he has a hard time reading and writing, and yet he's not an unintelligent man by any means, very smart man. But he always, you know, he's got low marks at school because his mind, it's just the way it works. He just can't fathom words and sentences, and he can't read them or write them. He's older now, he's 60 now, and so he's got a lifetime of, you know, endeavor behind him. So, but at school, he always had a problem, and yet he's a very smart man. Give him a, you know, set of tools and a purpose, and he can meet that purpose, no problem. It's just the way his mind works. And then there are others, for instance, myself, if you really want to fry my brain, give me a hammer and a nail, you know. Because there's no way on God's green earth that I'm going to get that in and easily and straight. It's just the way I am.
Yeah.
When it comes to photography, I must admit I'm thankful that I have a grip on the hard camera techniques. I'm not a technician, though, but I know the technicalities. But I also have a grip on the soft, as Michael says, the creative part. And it's the soft part that urges me to learn the hard part. And I'd love to talk about that whole flow of events. Where one becomes the other, either way, depending on how your mind works, and maybe devote a podcast to that, Bruce. Well, maybe we could do that next week.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay.
The interesting thing about that is that I think, you know, if you understand the hard part, like the technical part of it, then developing the creative side is something, if it hasn't come to you naturally up front, it is something that will develop over time if you keep practicing the art form. And I noticed during the week that longtime listener of ours, Landon Michelson, has just created this new profile picture, and he said on Facebook, this is my new avatar, and this is going everywhere that I promote myself online, you know, on Flickr, on Facebook, on all the websites that I visit. This is going to be my avatar from now on. And in the process of writing the little bit of blurb that went with that, he made the comment that he takes a picture every single day of his life. And I thought,
yeah,
that is just awesome. You know, if ever there was a way to lock yourself into that creative side of it, if you thought you were lacking it, not that I think Landon Michelson is lacking it by any stretch of the imagination.
You're brilliant, Landon. You really are.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, but by you know, forcing yourself to get out there and do it every single day, that creative side, if it hasn't come naturally, will soon develop itself, in my opinion anyway.
And I think you could equate that with music, you know. You might be able to, you know, pick up an instrument and understand it technically, you know, but you might not be able to actually make music because you understand the technicality of it, but, you know, you haven't got a... But if you played it long enough, if you listened to other music and then copied it, and then you would eventually find that you would be able to become more creative. You may never actually, you know, be the kind of creative person that others are, but you'll be your own creative person.
Yeah.
You know, the other side of that is that you have an understanding of the soft part. You might have a vision, but you have absolutely no idea how you're going to make that happen at a technical level. And every art that I can think of has both a scientific or technical aspect and a creative aspect.
Definitely.
You know, and so there's an interesting interplay there. And I must admit, if there's one thing that I've learned from my, you know, workshops, is that I've had both kinds of people turn up to my workshops. You know, some that are just, some that like have a grip on the hard but can't do the soft. Some that are just so visual, so artistic, so creative that, you know, it frustrates them because they haven't got the technicalities to get that to come to fruition. So I'd love to dedicate a show to Michael's contrast here between hard and soft.
Okay.
And look out for that in the coming week or two, I reckon.
All right, sounds good. It's funny because I remember hearing, I can't remember what I was listening to, this was a year or two back, and this person was talking about trying to learn a second language.
Uh-huh.
And they made the comment that one, it seems like a bizarre approach, but they said a really effective way to learn a foreign language is to buy a work of literary fiction that is written in that language and sit down and read it, even though you have no idea what the words are when you start reading it.
Mm.
They reckon that by the time you get to the end of the book, you will have picked up such a, you know, admittedly just a rudimentary understanding of the language, but it will be a very appropriate understanding of the language, if you will. Like, you'll have got the basics.
Yes.
And I thought that was a very interesting concept. Like, I can't imagine sitting down and reading something in, you know, Spanish or something, you know, some language that I don't speak, you know.
Mm-hmm. But it's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, how does a child learn language? The child learns language
through repetition,
you know, in the home that he's raised in by his exposure to it.
Yeah.
You know, so I would see that working. I mean, if you want to learn a language, move to the country and just live there. You have no choice.
Yeah, exactly.
And you will. You'll do it. You'll absolutely do it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I love language, absolutely love language. And if there's one thing I must admit that being on Facebook drives me absolutely crazy nuts is, you know, people's laziness in terms of spelling, punctuation, capitalization, spelling U with a U instead of Y-O-U, you know, it drives me crazy because it is the destruction of language. And language is what we use to communicate. It's how, you know, how do I know what the heck you're saying if there's not a comma there? There's not a, you know, full stop, a question mark. I have to interpret your thoughts and intentions rather than you making them plain and clear to me. And it's exactly the same with an art form. And so therefore, as with language, as with, you know, anything creative, there is a technical aspect to it and a creative aspect to it. You look at writing, for instance. A creative aspect, you can write. You might have the most beautiful prose pouring out of your body, pouring out of your mind and out of your, between your two lips. But if you don't know how to write that so that others read it the way that you intended it, what's the point?
Yeah.
If you just put down words without capitalization, without commas, without exclamation marks, question marks, full stops, you know, how is anybody going to be able to read it as you intended it? And it's exactly the same with the creative arts. And there is where, as with language, you need to understand the technicalities of it so that you can speak it and write it so that it's understood. And with any piece of music you write, you need to convey it at a technical level so that the creative part of it has the impact that you intend. So, I'm going to make some notes on this. We're going to talk about this at length.
Cool.
Because I really think this is where photographers fall down.
Excellent. Well, I'll look forward to it.
So thank you, Michael, for that. Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
And Shelton, you said that you and your son have been kicking around a discussion topic based on senses.
Well, yeah. Nathan hasn't been feeling that good the last few days. He went to the Melbourne show the other night with a whole bunch of pretty young girls.
Uh-huh.
You know, as you do when you're 18 years old.
Yep.
And it started to rain. It doesn't rain all that much in Melbourne, but it started to rain.
Bollocks.
And so being a chivalrous young man, that's the way I raised him, he gave all his jumpers and coats to the girls. And he wound up getting a cold that's kept him home from work all week. You know, it's been an expensive bit of active chivalry. But so we were sitting around talking today on the couch, and he was looking at the price of the new Sony A850, which in Melbourne is retailing it for about $2,900-ish, right?
Yep.
It was going to come out at about $3,400, $3,500, but they've brought it down to about $2,900, which is very good because then it goes head-to-head with, I suppose, the D700, etc.
Yep.
But I don't think it's anywhere near the camera that the D700 is, but that's just me.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing is that Nathan was saying that he gets people coming into his store where he's working in, you know, in photo retail, and they say, what's the cheapest full frame SLR on the market? Just tell me that. As if the criteria for their purchase is sensor size.
Oh, so this is the new megapixel.
This is, yeah. Yes. Maybe it is, Bruce. I hadn't thought of it like that. Maybe it is. How many megapixels is that?
Yeah.
You know, is it a full frame sensor? Yeah. Right. Well, for instance, you know, it's an interesting thought. Now, I am, as we've often said, averse to the term full frame sensor.
Yep.
And I think that very term is the point at which we get confused. It's a very clever marketing term, and it was cleverly instituted by Canon to indicate that if your camera doesn't have this size sensor, it's not a full frame sensor. Now, the psychology of that is interesting. First of all, as I've often said on this podcast, every camera has a full frame sensor.
Yeah.
That has always been the case and always will be the case.
Yes, it's just a different size.
It's just a different size. To say that 35mm is the benchmark would be, and then go back, you know, into the days of film, would be incorrect. 35mm was the most common and popular format, but not necessarily the most advantageous. It's a horses for courses thing.
Yep.
And it's exactly the same. It's exactly the same in digital. But Nathan saying, nonetheless, these fellas come in and they say, you know, what's the cheapest price on a full-frame camera, mate? Because if it's not full-frame, then what is it, Bruce? It's something less than full.
Yeah.
And the psychology of that expression is misleading, to say the least. So let's talk about that. What are the advantages and disadvantages of both sizes in a digital SLR? I don't want to get technical because I'm not a technical guy. I just want to talk practical, you know, from a pragmatic point of view.
Okay.
And so first of all, let's not call it a full frame sensor from this point on. Let's call it a 35mm size sensor. All right, that to me makes more sense. And then we've got the APS-C size or APS size sensor, which is a crop sensor, if that's what you want to call it. I again believe that to call something a crop sensor has a psychology attached to it that is misleading, because it's cropping. It doesn't give me the full thing.
Yeah.
And they're terms that are used to sell, or they can be very misleading. Okay. So let's talk about the sensor that has been around since really, you know, the late 90s when digital SLRs became available. And that is the APS size sensor, you know, which found its way into the Nikon D1 and, you know, the early Canons and all the rest of them, and still find themselves in cameras like all of the Canon range, the 40D, the 50D, and the, you know, the Nikon range, the D300, the D300S, the D90, the D5000, the, you know, Sony range. And, of course, you've got the 4/3 sensor that's in the Olympus range and the Panasonic range. The smaller sensors, what is their advantage? What is their disadvantage? Well, their advantage is the fact that any lens that you put on is magnified. That's the first port of call from a practical perspective. So if you have an 80 to 200 2.8 or 70 to 200 2.8 and you are used to shooting with a 35mm film camera, which a lot of our listeners may not have ever used actually in their life because the digital's been around for so long and so many of our readers are newcomers, our listeners are newcomers to photography. But if you are used to using a 70 to 200 2.8 at, you know, on a 35mm camera, you got 4 times magnification at 200mm, approximately. because the rough 1:1 standard, or the rough sort of one or standard magnification, was a 50mm lens, gave you approximately, you know, a standard eye to camera magnification. So you used to sort of say, well, I've got a 200mm lens, divide that by 50, that's 4. So a 200mm is approximately a 4 times magnification. A 300mm would be a 6 times magnification. But now, of course, you've got a 200mm lens on a sensor that's smaller. And so therefore, it crops either times 1.5 or 1.6. That means that effectively, you've got, in 35mm terms, the equivalent of a 300mm 2.8. Now, that's certainly effective if you're a sports shooter or if you're a wildlife shooter. And I don't think that there'd be too many sports shooters or wildlife shooters that would see great benefit in going back to what we'd call a full-frame sensor, a 35mm size sensor, and reducing the magnification of their lenses, because they are able to get a 2.8 aperture at 300mm with the price of a 70-200 or a 200mm lens.
Yeah.
I know in my case, the 85mm 1.8 that I have loved and extolled on this podcast since time immemorial, I actually prefer to use that with an APS-C sensor camera than my D700. It has greater reach, but it still has that beautiful 1.8 aperture, and to be honest with you, is sharper than on my D700, because it uses that sweet spot in the middle of the optics that we forget about when we talk about a larger sensor. So there's certain, you know, but the disadvantages of a camera with an APS size sensor are, is dynamic range, essentially dynamic range.
And inherent noise, because the photo sites are closer together.
Yep, absolutely, absolutely. So you've got this crossover here. If I have a Nikon D300, say, or D300S, this camera resolves at, what are they, 12 megapixel? Something like that.
You're the Nikon expert, not me.
Oh, I don't know. How many pixels is that? I think they're 12. So you have 12 megapixels in an APS size sensor. Now, you also have 12 megapixels in a D700. Now, if you do your math, you'll understand you've got the same amount of pixel sites, the same amount of photo sites on the sensor from a smaller sensor to a larger sensor. What is the advantage then of either? Well, as I said, you've got the reach of a crop sensor like the APS, but you've got the dynamic range and the noise capabilities of, you know, a large sensor like the D700. Now, I can shoot a D700 at 3200 ISO and not worry. Yes, there's noise, but, you know, I could print it in a magazine and it wouldn't worry me, really wouldn't worry me. But I've captured the image. That's the main part. I can go to 3200, open up my lens in the worst possible light and capture the image. Now, I could also capture that image with a D300 or a D90 or a Canon 50D or whatever, but it would be noisier. Right?
Yep.
I also would have had to stand back further if I was using a prime, right? So, you know, there's all these playoffs. To say that a full-frame sensor is the best is actually wrong, because, you know, there are certain advantages in sharpness and certain advantages in terms of magnification that an APS-C sensor gives you. But if you're a person who likes to work in low light, or you're a landscape shooter who loves dynamic range, a portrait shooter that loves dynamic range, a larger sensor would possibly suit you better. I would suggest, if you're going to buy two cameras, buy both.
Yeah.
You know, I know that, you know, the fellow we often mention on this podcast, Richard Annable. G'day, Richard. Know you'll be listening. He'll take his D700 and his D300 and his D200 and use them all for different things. He'll put his 80-200 or his 70-200. He's got a 80-200. He'll put that on his D300. And get, you know, beautiful images during the ceremony of a wedding from a distance at 2.8, but he may swap that over to his D700 when he's doing some of the formal shots and doing some portraits, because he wants that extra dynamic range. He wants, you know, better segue between the highlight and the shadow that the D700 gives him, that the D300 may not give him to the same degree. But to say that one resolves better than the other would be incorrect. because probably, technically speaking, the D300 would resolve better than the D700. So, you know, don't think that these expressions full frame or crop sensor have anything to do with image quality in terms of resolution. They have everything to do with how you shoot and everything to do with noise and dynamic range. Now, noise is an interesting thing, and dynamic range is an interesting thing. The reason that a camera with a larger sensor gives you greater dynamic range is because the photo site is larger, and therefore it can gather more photons of light and therefore give you greater dynamic range across the board. But a smaller pixel actually will give you greater sharpness. So, you've got all these playoffs. My suggestion would be, as I said, go out and buy one of each. But don't ever say that one is better than the other, because as in the days of film, they are just simply horses for courses. The other thing that we're learning, too, is that technology is getting so much better than in terms of noise and how cameras handle noise than it ever was. I own a D700, and my son owns a D90. But he is happy to shoot at 1600 on a D90. At 3200, he starts to get concerned, more so than I would. But at 1600, he can shoot with the D90 and not really bat an eyelid, because the technology in that sensor and the technology behind the sensor, in terms of how the camera deals with the noise in the JPEG it produces.
So the image processor.
Yes, the image processing, the software actually in the camera, and the hardware, are superb. But he has an advantage over me when he puts his 85mm on, because he essentially gets a 127mm lens at f1.8. I have an 85mm lens, effectively, equivalent, 35mm equivalent, at 1.8. So he has greater reach. Possibly even a sharper image, because of the fact that, you know, at 1.8 he's using a more central part of the optics. I'm using edge to edge, so, you know, there's all these playoffs. So if you're thinking of purchasing a camera and you're going from an APS size sensor to a larger sensor simply because someone's called it full frame and you think, oh, mine's not full frame, oh, mine can't be as good, you're sadly mistaken.
And one other issue that I think warrants bringing up here, and correct me if I'm wrong, but is there not also the possibility that people who have bought lenses which are designed for an APS-C size sensor can get bitten on the butt if they then move to a body that uses a 35mm sensor?
Absolutely, yeah, and a very good point. A lot of lenses are designed only to resolve with the smaller sensors. That's especially true of wide angle lenses. I was given an 11-18mm lens by Tamron, right? Now, if I put that on my D700, I have to get to almost the other end of the scale before I don't get any vignetting. But on Nathan's D90, oh, he loves it. He can go right back to 11mm and, you know, he's got 18mm equivalent. No, he'd have a 16mm equivalent or something.
Yeah, right.
In terms of 35mm. So that's a beautiful thing. But you're absolutely right. Some of the lenses that you buy, if you are going from one format size to another, will not work until either you zoom out to a certain point or they may not work at all. I remember trying Tamron asked me to try the 18 to 270 VC lens that they have. That's a hell of a lens, 18 to 270. I mean,
that's a big range.
That's a hell of a range. And I had my Fuji S5 on me in Patagonia, which has an APS size sensor, and I had my D700 with me. And I was working with the Fuji and the 18 to 270, and it was producing some lovely pictures. I was very impressed with that lens, by the way. The moment that I switched it over to the D700, naturally, at the 18mm end, it vignetted because, you know, it's designed for a smaller sensor. But I thought that if I zoom out, I'll get to a point where it no longer vignettes. But actually, even at 270, it vignetted.
And wow.
Because it's just the way that lens, those optics are designed. So if you already have lenses, apart from, you know, prime lenses, you'd probably need to be concerned about some of them that that, you know, that you've got, and make sure that they're able to work between both. Or if you're going to what we might call upgrade, for want of a better expression, from a, you know, smaller sensor to a larger sensor, make sure that you don't have to buy a whole new range of lenses. If you're a Canon user, then you will definitely have to consider it. Very much so.
Why Canon more so than anyone else?
Well, their lenses mount differently. And both with Canon, Nikon, and any other format, some lenses are designed only for what Nikon call DX size sensors, or what are commonly known as, you know, APS-C size sensors. You'd be very, very careful. You know, I've had that issue, and I've given some lenses to my son because they just don't work on my D700 anymore. So he was very happy about that. You know, there's a lens, son. Oh, thanks, Dad. I've always loved prime lenses, and so that wouldn't be a problem on either. Not that I'm aware of. I can't think of any prime lenses that would cause an issue on either camera. But it's just that you have to understand that the differences. If you're a wide-angle guy, if you're a guy who loves shooting landscapes, I would think of nothing better than a larger sensor, because your 20mm prime is the 35mm equivalent that you are used to.
Yeah.
It doesn't become a 30mm. You know, when you put it on, if you were to use a D300 to shoot landscapes, you've got to get this seriously wide piece of glass to get the same width that you were used to getting, you know, when you shot 35mm film. But if you're a wildlife shooter, a bird shooter, a sports shooter, is a full frame, for want of a better expression, insert that here, is a larger sensor going to actually be an advantage to you? I would suggest it would be a serious disadvantage to you.
Yeah.
You have less reach, and you have, you have to work harder to get the same magnification. You have to hold a bigger lens. There's pluses and minuses with either. So don't just walk into your local camera store and say, hey, what's the cheapest full-frame sensor camera on the market? Is that really what you want? The salesman would be wise to ask you, well, may I ask, why do you want that size sensor? What kind of photography are you going to do? If the answer is, well, I love doing portraits in studio, or I love doing landscapes, well, then maybe you have a valid point.
He's not going to do that any more than he did talk people down on megapixels in the first place, mate.
Well, yeah, that's obvious. Awesome. That's very true. A lot of salesmen are just going to say, yeah, no worries. Well, that would be the Sony A850, and that's $29.95. You know, what color paper bag do you want me to put it in? And then the person walks out of the store thinking that they've got the best thing they could possibly get for the money. But not necessarily. You know, a D300 is about the same price. But to be honest with you, between the two cameras, I know which one I would have in a heartbeat. I've got nothing against Sony other than their funny flash system, which you even had to battle with because
yep.
You use a Minolta up in Tuca. The fact that their sensors at higher ISOs are very noisy. I'd get better noise out of a small size sensor in the D300 or the 300S, I reckon, than the 850, but I'd have to wait for reviews and comparisons on that. But the you haven't necessarily walked out with what you want or what you need. If you're a wildlife photographer, man, you want the smaller sensor so you can use a 200mm lens instead of a 300mm lens.
Yeah.
And you're not necessarily going to need to shoot at 1600 ISO. You know, you may at times, but these cameras are still capable of doing that. But
yeah.
A landscape shooter, portrait shooter, someone who wants, you know, all that beautiful dynamic range, would have a better job with a larger sensor by and by. Now, there are technical differences between all of them. I remember doing a test between the Sony A900 and the Nikon D700 at 100 ISO and at 800 ISO. At 100 ISO, they were both pretty much the same in terms of noise. At 800 ISO, they were chalk and cheese. The D700 had hardly shifted in terms of noise. The Sony A900 was it was as noisy as you could possibly imagine. The model was wearing a black jumper or sweater if you're an American. And you can see, you know, random colored pixels throughout this whole part of the photograph. Whereas you couldn't see them that much, hardly at all, until you seriously magnified on the D700. And then what's the point of that? I mean, who's going to do that anyway?
Yeah.
But it was visible. Same size sensor and the same, you know, technology sensor in the Sony A900. Now, if they haven't corrected that, that means that the A850 is going to have the same issue. And I'll tell you now that the D300, even though it's a smaller sensor, will give you better noise at the same ISO levels. A photographer friend of mine, Darren Leal, who's one of Australia's most renowned nature and travel photographers, he runs some of the photo tours that I work on. He went Sony recently and he got an A900 and he loved its resolving power, but he hated the way it focused and he didn't like it at high ISOs. So he's come over from the dark side and he's now about to get himself a D3, which has nowhere near as many pixels, right? It's half the pixel rate, but he prefers the camera. So there's all sorts of things to think about if you're buying a camera. But as you say, Bruce, perhaps sensor size is going to be the new how many pixels is that question that we don't really understand.
Yeah.
So research what your needs are. Research what the camera actually performs like. And you can do that on DP Review and so many other sites. And then say, okay, this is what I shoot. This is what I produce. These are the conditions under which I work. These are the lenses I already own. And make your decision based on those factors, rather than some phrasing like full frame sensor that is misleading and may not actually be what you need.
Very interesting. Thank you, mate.
Oh, my pleasure. I'd love to get some feedback on this, by the way.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely.
To see what you've come up with yourself, if you've owned both cameras, what you've found, if you had to make a decision recently based on that, what decision you made and how you came up with it. All of these things I'd love to know, because I think you're right, Bruce. This could be the new catchphrase.
Yeah, definitely. All right. Keep those emails coming in, studio@audiotou.com, or hit us on the forum at audiotou.com/forum, or if you're a member of 5 Minute Photographer, head on down there, or hit either of us on Facebook. You can get us messages just about anywhere on the interwebs.
I get the feeling we're contactable, don't you?
Just a touch.
But we love to be in contact with all of you, actually. We really do. And again, thank you for your emails. Michael, yours will be discussed at length, that's for sure.
Beautiful. All right, mate. We'll talk with you next week.
Fantastic. Good on you, mate.
See ya.
See ya.
This has been another AudioToYou.com podcast. For previous episodes, check out
ShuttersIncPodcast.com.
Please send questions, comments, or feedback to studio@AudioToYou.com.